Something strange happened to me recently. I've had a lot of technological problems. My mini disc deck gave up the other just yesterday. I can't use my mini disc deck anymore. My portable mini disc got, I think it was my Mordecai, who's 22 months old, must have put it somewhere, but I can't find that anywhere. And then my tape machine broke, but it did something quite interesting before it bust, which is I had a tape of Elvis love songs in it, and it was coming out at maybe 10 times, 8 times too fast. So everything was coming up like that. And I'm getting increasing respect for late Elvis. I think he's been given a bad write-up by all the people who loved early Elvis. They kind of prove how much they like early Elvis by slagging off the late Elvis. And I've always thought that there was something interesting about his openness to new pop music. Like when Guitar Man was a hit, he heard it on the radio and said, "That's fantastic, I love it. We must get..." And in the end, they had to get the guitar player from the hit record in to play for Elvis because he wanted that guitar player. So he's sort of open and to Latin music, and he was kind of open to everything. He wanted to make music of everything, and he pulled it all in. And he has a kind of what I call an isomplastic imperative. That's a word meaning bringing everything to one. He wanted everything in there. And I find that really interesting, and it's like a reply to religion in a way. And so I take Elvis, late Elvis, I have quite a high opinion of it. But coming out really, really fast, it really impressed me because each song had a completely different shape. And then it occurred to me that I was like some slow-moving, slow-living, godlike giant listening to Elvis had become this little performing gnat. Because his songs were passing so fast that things that would take him 4 minutes to sing, I could hear in 12 seconds, that I was able to stick him on the head of a pin. I was gazing down at him. And I could understand the structures of his songs, and I could see them at an instant. It was kind of what you call a synoptic view, a view all at once. And it kind of made me feel, why have I been listening to records at the right speed all my life?
Okay, so let me read you what you said on a recent Out to Lunch show. I have the script here. Here's what you said following up on that insight. Out to Lunch, meaning you, blushed crimson. 35 years of writing about mass-produced music, attempting the Olympian detachment of Marx and Joyce towards the hurly-burly of bourgeois fame-seeking and banal careerism, and he spent most of it listening to records at the correct speed. For the duration, not to mention the long durée, he'd manfully tried to treat records as objects susceptible to analytical scrutiny, yet he'd continued to replay them untampered, producing the illusion of the artist moaning and groaning and sweating in real time again and again, as if this communion could ever be more than a fraudulent wet wafer tasting of soggy cardboard. Tamper Red would scold him to the echo. He'd been an astronomer refusing to look through a telescope, a biologist insisting that the naked eye provided a more accurate picture of muscle tissue than that provided by a microscope, a collagist without a prit stick.
We've had prit stick before discussion. You don't know what a prit stick is. A prit stick is a stick of glue in a plastic case. And one of the explanations of the term is that they deliberately wanted women in offices to make jokes about penises. So they called it something a bit like the word for prick. But I think that's actually apocryphal, because I suddenly realized that the way the glue comes out is based on a lipstick. And the reason they call it a prit stick is because it sounds like lipstick, because it's like a gigantic lipstick, except glue comes out instead of lipstick. Yeah.
Did you just realize that now?
It was over the last few days, because I was puzzling, because some of these very obvious things seem to be the big communication problems. I mean, it took me ages on Bongo Fury to work out what a Milton Bradley crayon was. An American had to tell me that that's a common crayon that is used in the States. And similarly, I was quite surprised that you don't have prit sticks. I mean, it's the easiest way to glue, because you get no glue on your fingers. You can imagine a big lipstick. You wind it at the bottom, out comes the glue, you can smear it on, and you have to remember to put the cap back, otherwise it dries up and then you can't use it anymore. So I'm always chasing the children saying, put the cap back on the prit stick.
I did not know what it is.
And the collages you see without a Pritt stick would be somebody who's trying to do something that hasn't got the basic tool. And okay. That's how I felt being a rock critic or a music critic and always listening to my records at the right speed. Because I'm trying to analyze these things that are material objects and I'm still treating them as windows on a real person, whereas in fact one should treat them as objects.
Okay, so you felt like a collagist. You had been for 35 years a collagist without a Pritt stick.
That's right.
In your actual record listening practice, you'd been a rank romantic realist. Ooh, sin.
Three R's.
R cubed, reproducing all the errors he denounced in Politics and Philosophy. Exclamation mark. See, this is quite honest of you, Ben. You actually hit the eureka of what a dummy I've been. Right when I thought I was the only one not dumb. Of course, people don't even know what you're talking about here, probably. But anyways, or why you're getting the insight out of it. But you then have to go back to your mentor and say, oh, that's what he meant. Because you quote Zappa, it's a universe of rates. R-A-T-E-S, Zappa once said, his own albums continually highlighting the abutments of incommensurate scale necessary to perceive the totality without prejudice or partiality. Out to Lunch knew there was something wrong with records which simply reproduced the exact same rate at which they'd been recorded, as if speed-ups or slowdowns were somehow against nature. From Deutsche Grammophon to Simp. What's Simp? C-I-M-P.
Simp was it's a Bob Rusch's operation. He has North Country Music, which sells a lot of the Cadence magazine. It's a mail order catalog of new jazz and old jazz, and he set up a label called Simp, standing for I can't remember what it stands for. CIMP, Contemporary Improvised Music Productions, something like that. And he had a very purist recording policy of digital recording. No effects. People went into the same room each time, recorded, and that was it. They didn't want any manipulation. It was very against any kind of dressing up of the recording. The idea of a complete transparency, that you listen to the CD and you really get what's there. The result is, unfortunately, even though I was very excited with the idea when it first came, is that the recordings are frequently not as powerful as other recordings people have made, in which they've thought about people's use of the recording and what might be best to have on a CD in a room, if you see what I mean. Thinking about the product as product. And this purism, it seems to me, is a bit of a distraction. It seems to me to filter over from the classical world.
Right, and it's even worse with this new epiphany you're getting, because you say from Deutsche Grammophon to Simp, a desert of wasted opportunity, of stunted possibility, of fetishized, boring places called concert halls. Damn the rituals of a culture masquerading as religion. His domestic, Out to Lunch's domestic hi-fi should be the ground and figure of maximum invention. What was against nature was dictating how a recording should be used. As far as he was concerned, records were objects in themselves, not simply transparent windows on real events in the past. His philosophy of isomplastic presentness saw the past in quotes, saw the past as a matter of interpreting traces, not some Narnia-like parallel existence.
Ah, Narnia. Do you know about Narnia? C.S. Lewis?
Yes,
The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, yeah. Children's books.
Not some Narnia-like parallel existence the historian enters through his bedroom wardrobe. In fact, one reason Lunch likes Zappa and Hendrix and Prince Jammy and Prince Farai or Farai?
Farai. You don't know Prince Farai?
Never heard of him. Don't
he's
know
the
him.
Captain Beefheart of reggae. He's died now, but he worked here with Adrian Sherwood, and he's got the most extraordinary deep voice. And when I first heard him on Plant Up singing Natty Dread on Addy Telephone, I was quite terrified, and I've loved him ever since.
Okay, and Prince Farai, all those princes, and Iancu Dumitrescu, so much.
They deal with different rates of recording.
Right, so you're right. You liked all these guys, and Dumitrescu so much was the reason you liked them so much was because they broke the representational piety of straight recording.
Yeah, but I only realized that once my tape recorder broke, and I heard these pipping sounds, which I found very interesting to hear. I mean, I think my ear had been slightly prepared by drum and bass, which was a fashion for the last 5-6 years in England. It's kind of an extension of reggae and dub. in which there's a lot of sped up drums, a lot of use of the wrong speed in terms of compiling the records.
Okay, and the representational piety of straight recording and overlay. Okay, they broke the representational piety of straight recording and overlay tracks recorded at different speeds so that conventions of playback became concrete and explicit. Speed Freak Boogie, like all Zappa's tracks, it wasn't just a piece of music. It was a polemic and a manifesto, a pointed rejoinder to the general idiocy. Okay, so that's the crux of the epiphany. And isn't it interesting? To me, it is becoming aware of the medium and how you projected your cultural filters normally conditioned into you. You regarded the object for what it was. You did not see through the object. And so, you know, radical modernism takes the object and puts it in another context.
Mm.
But this was taking and hearing it in another context, which had not occurred to you in relation to the object.
Mm.
So this is a great insight.
Well,
but it has all kinds of problems for you, right?
All kinds of problems. I mean, a certain sort of facile way of using this insight is elementary art school. Is you get a whole load of people in a room and you amaze them by being very high-handed with the normal things that people do, and you decide that making a complete mess of things is really creative and exciting, and people go out from there thinking they're experimental artists straight away, and thinking that if they do a DJ where they put their thumb on the record and slow it down, they're being extremely radical. And obviously, just sort of screwing around with things in themselves will not necessarily produce some fantastic moment.
Right, for general consumption. But it was a fantastic moment for you.
Yeah.
And maybe life is a series of about four punctuated huge epiphanies, and that's about all you get. But you require lots of span of time to lead up to the big flip point or breakthrough. So that's one point. How many of these eurekas can you have? And then the other thing is, yes.
Well, I mean, the thing is, Out to Lunch is a fictional character, so I think he can have as many, you know, we could speed him up and he could have one every second.
Well, that's what happens when you're talking to me.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so, but let's go into this. I was very impressed with you recognizing this, and yet, let me see, I'm trying to remember how. Okay, so it just insulted you that you had taken a consumer's thing on face value and had not known to break it, to change it, to smudge it. That point is what outrages you, right? Why did you take the experience? Well, I would say because it was so much fun to hear music done normally, right? The pleasure of regular music.
There was enough there. I mean, if somebody is turning the world upside down by, you know, releasing records which everybody's understanding, then good luck to them. That's what's happening. It was more an inkling, an intimation of looking at things from the point of view of eternity, or at least a far more stretched time. Because this, once you're hearing something at this rate of speed up, you're sort of somebody who's going to live several millennia. And it's the idea of looking at one's life from outside. Now, in some ways, I think this might be a moment of religion in my thinking, and something that I need to shake off. Imagining oneself from the outside being one of the primary religious tricks that people don't usually think of themselves from the outside. But if you can get them to think of themselves from the outside, then they're going to start imagining God. And there's a huge list of exploitative, nonsensical things you can do to people once you get them thinking along these lines.
Yeah, so your epiphany is also a point of absurdity. You've been trying to see the structure of so much genres of human experience, the structure, the ground of so much, the very act of doing that got crystallized to this absurd point where you were so excited over seeing the structure of the music. Of the creative artist, that you forgot. Hey, you got enjoyment out of it, but that's what you're wrestling with. You can't sell that. You just think of all the regular recorded speeds you've enjoyed. See, isn't that it? You become aware of your effort to become detached. And yes, it's you've become aware of the religious streak that always was in you, to have the God's eye view.
Yeah, but I've sort of encountered this before in arguing around the idea of totality, whether the idea of totality is immediately oppressive and leads towards totalitarianism, which seems to be the average postmodern politics, that if you try and imagine the totality, you're doing something oppressive to everybody. And working out that without an idea of everything, no one can really talk to each other, that the idea of everything is a fundamental necessity for two individuals to talk to each other seriously or comically, but to have a real conversation with someone, they need to share this idea.
Yeah, let me just say this. I'm reminded, read 40 years ago, some philosopher said that in our understanding or perception or thinking, there's the particular framework and then there's the larger maybe meaning. So you always need a figure ground. And this may be just a literary conditioning, but you have to have, you're always relating the particular to a larger realm of meaning or framework or rules or guidelines.
But being coming from North America yourself, you must be aware of a philosophical movement called pragmatism.
Yeah.
Which in effect says that thinking about totality is a kind of distraction, and that we must look at the matter in hand. And for me, this is actually the end of philosophy, the end of speculation, the end of thought moving.
Yeah.
Even though, I mean, I admire John Dewey personally, and he defended Trotsky very nobly, as a spokesman and as a media figure. I've got nothing against John Dewey personally. But when it comes to philosophy, I have real problems with pragmatism, because it seems to cut off exactly the speculation that gets me excited. In which I do go into areas which are normally handled by religion, and therefore very pragmatic people would say, well, I've obviously got religious tendencies and I should lop them off. But my feeling is that these tendencies towards talking about everything is where everybody goes. I mean, I think it's impossible for two people to drink a bottle of wine together on a hot night with a cloudless sky and not start talking about everything, however unreligious they are.
Oh, yeah, I didn't finish that. So the meaning, the larger level, mm-hmm. that's the everything level.
Yeah.
So you have the everything level and the particular, and you oscillate back and forth.
Plato defined dialectics as finding the correct steps between these two things. Now, there are a lot of bad ways of going from everything to the particular, especially claiming that I know everything and therefore you should listen to me, and I wear a funny robe and do special rituals, and I call that religion. And I object to that as a method and of dealing with this issue. So I'm not saying every way of dealing with the issue of everything to the particular is the correct way, but I'm saying some way of dealing it is required for us to be happy thinking people.
Yeah, and probably you could go into the technical media environment of Dewey, which is in the 30s and 20s and 30s, I think, and you look at, he's dealing with the information overload of the radio environment, movies and all that, is that he actually flipped into an absurd position, but it was a reaction of a literary person to a larger everything that was going on.
Sorry, who's the he then? Who are you talking about?
Oh, John Dewey. John
right.
Dewey, in the 20s and 30s, I think, when he wrote, he was reacting, and this is what McLuhan says, that the concepts that people come up with are reacting to an invisible ground, but it explains why his philosophy was significant, because he was saying, let's get back to the particulars. In my terms, he was trying to get back to some chemical body issues and did not want to deal with some other literary frameworks because they were being erased by the immediate environment.
Well, this is your McLuhanite way of interpreting it, at least a Dobbsian McLuhanism. And I'd offer to listeners to this my Marxist explanation, which would be that John Dewey, as a liberal who believed in the capitalist system, found that any attempt to imagine the whole of what the capitalist system does as dangerous to his the practice that he believed in among the business community that he's defending. So rather than a response to radio and television particularly, I think it's a response to communism, and it's a response to trying to imagine the consequences of capitalist activity, because Marxism has in it this will to understand the whole system and to try and imagine what the whole system is doing, not simply be advice about how to behave. I mean, we have a lot of study of capitalism under capitalism. It's called business studies, and it's all about how to compete with the other guy. But from the point of view of real knowledge, it's kind of absurd teaching everybody how to compete with each other, because they'll all compete even better, and then we're back where we started. So from a global perspective, or from a holistic perspective, business studies is kind of crazy.
Right, but it is understandable as a figure in the ground that when there's no need to fight and compete over everything, because the information environment offers so much interesting experience relatively for free, at least in the 1560s before pay TV and all that. So you have this, it was very hard to get people to find something to compete about. So they actually had to teach it. It's like teaching them to breathe. You could say, I'm teaching the chemical body to breathe because you're too ecstatic in the chip body and TV body to notice to use that, you know?
Well, I don't think there was any let-up in competition of capitalist entities with each other in the...
But they had to teach it, which is silly. They would not have done that in 1850. You don't teach competition. Back then you had to survive, well, at least in the industrial...
But isn't this the filtration into academia of any particular observation or skill can become an area of expertise? I mean, one day we'll have people who are Bob and Ben experts, and they'll have studied all our programs and gone into the five-bodied website and gone into the militant aesthetics website and worked out what these two crazy people were talking about, and they'll be experts on us. I mean, it seems to me that any activity can be translated into a specialist knowledge, which then people can claim they know best about and then teach other people. And of course, when they do that, they actually ruin any knowledge which has a relationship to the totality, because knowledge which has a relationship to the totality cannot be a specialism. It always has to face what everybody is doing and what everybody's thinking about, which is why we're doing internet radio rather than holding positions within any academic institution, because we don't claim to know anything about anything in particular. We claim to be a response to what's happening to everybody.
Yes, and so we, let's put, since they'll study this show number 35, is it?
We're on 36.
36.
You see, I'm a better Bob and Ben expert than you are.
So for the record, I'm quoting McLuhan. If there are any McLuhanites, you can count me out. That's what McLuhan said. If there are any McLuhanites growing up around me, don't include me.
Well, he borrowed that line from someone who preceded him, which was Karl Marx, who said, "Thank God I'm not a Marxist."
And Karl got that from Jesus. So we're saying, if there are any Bob and Benites, your courses, we are not attending.
Yeah, that's it.
I once met Jesus, and I said to him I would never go to his church, and he shook my hand.
All right, because in fact he's a Zen Buddhist.
Yes, or even more than that. I wouldn't say he was anything.
Yeah, but this is a very familiar pattern, isn't it? The one of the person who sets up some institution or practice or style or mode of behaving. And then,
isn't that what Weber, the sociologist, called? You know, charismatic becomes routinization, you know, about 100 years ago.
You could put it like that. I mean, what's the last example that you've observed around you of this process happening, of somebody doing something which seems really valuable and good and then seems to turn into something repellent?
Everybody I cite, Frank Zappa, Marshall McLuhan, William Henry Thompson, Lyndon LaRouche, James Joyce, Finnegan's Wake, me, you.
Yeah, but what have they produced? What's bad about what they've produced that you're reacting to?
Oh, I'm talking about their followers.
Right. So
their followers, their institutionalization of them.
If it's particular to one of them. So you're interested in the kind of, I call this triangulation. I mean, I had to think about this when I was writing my book on Derek Bailey, who's a free improviser. And I had to explain that I was not a free improvising ideologue, that I had a place for composition within my my understanding of how to make great music, despite the fact that Derek was totally against composition, and that I felt that a triangulation was required, that you needed Frank Zappa and that you needed Derek Bailey, but you also needed, you know, other people in my constellation in order to arrive at the thoughts about Derek that I was having, that the absolute follower of Derek wouldn't be able to get it.
Okay, so you're saying that you had the problem that you were composing, and then the second point is that your composition was justified because it included other points of reference in relation to Derek. Is that
I've got sympathy with your call of people, and then your dissatisfaction with all the people who base themselves on one of them.
Yeah. It's the keeping it the, so, you know, if I had created another version of Chart, I'd just put everything on it. I mean, that's what was so great about Freakout. Zappa listed like 179 influences. That'd never been done before. Right?
Yeah.
He was trying to put everything on there.
Yeah.
His way of doing everything.
But he was aware of, you see, I think quite deliberately of mentioning names that no one could possibly know, names of school teachers, names of friends. even now, the most expert Zappologists are still arguing about who Pepper is or that you have obscurities on there, because obviously we are influenced by obscurities as well. And I took that also as a blow against T.S. Eliot, that when you're trying to master culture and you're learning culture at school via the English language, one of the things you read is T.S. Eliot, because it's famously difficult, and it's the little piece of difficult modernism which is fed to you as being the thing you've got to master. And one of the illusions fostered by Eliot is that culture is this kind of known lexicon that you can master, and once you've mastered it, you can make references to it, and that's okay because it's part of culture. And Zappa's against that. He follows more the Joycean route of referring to anything at all, even if it's under the radar of official culture, because it has affected him. And if that means that it's not immediately readable by another educated person, that doesn't matter, because the energy of expression is going to carry something through, which will create curiosity on the part of a person, and then they may investigate and find out what these things are.
That's why I love reading the list. To me, I guess it was immediately, I knew he was citing, you know, teachers and friends as well as the greats in different arts, is I recognize a democratic impulse in there. Like, that's what Marx is talking about. It's solidarity with the people. You know, it was so such a pleasure to see someone do that. And I've always tried to do that. If I was given the opportunity to list something, I definitely will bring in something that's not known or that's my friend.
Yeah.
Like we talk about Gamma. That's sort of an example.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because the guardians of official discourse, and I know your feeling is that because of the growth of the internet and the way TV is diversified, that this authority doesn't exist. But in working in England, one is very aware of the BBC and of official channels. I mean, my partner, Professor Esther Leslie, appeared on Radio 4 recently with Melvyn Bragg, who's a famous cultural commentator. And she got an audience of 2 million people to listen to herself talk about the Frankfurt School one morning on Radio 4. And the amount of responses she got was, it made my 7 years of work at Resonance FM, you know, pale into insignificance. You know, this 1 hour was, you know, really put her under the spotlight. And one of the things that 10 years ago, I did quite a lot of work for the BBC. I was on Radio 4 and Radio 3 talking about music. And whenever they had to deal with a black American, they seemed to call me up. They seemed to think I was an expert on that because I knew a bit about jazz. And my experience of it was that an absolute fear of you naming anything which wasn't already heard of by the person interviewing you. The way they put it was always, our audience won't understand. But this, the audience won't understand, I began to realise is actually a defence of their own little set of things that they know about, and they don't want to hear about anything that's new. And the way I formulated this recently, I thought, I'm only ever going to listen to critics who tell me about somebody I've never heard of, because then it's of interest. Then there's a reason why they're bringing up this name, and that this this sort of so-called popularizing argument that if you talk about something our listeners haven't heard of, it's kind of an offense to them, is actually a way of eliminating a real democracy. That the democracy you notice in the list of names, even though it's full of names you've never heard of, that the real democratic thing allows in what you haven't heard of. And this has got completely lost in the sort of new populist, anti-elitist kind of pseudo-politics that dominates, at least, you know, from my perspective, I feel it dominates media. I don't know how you feel from your Maui perspective on that.
No, that's right. And when you say I celebrate the decentralization that TV and the internet made, that's not exactly how we do a media ecological approach. We look at the effects, and actually TV and the internet requires more centralization for literate industrial cultures because it's a compensation. Because literate people have a limited view, conditioned that way to specialize, they cannot allow into their thinking or experience this decentralization. So the rise of fascism, totalitarianism, the Patriots Bill, all that is what Bill Gates caused. Bill Gates and Wired Magazine are trying to, you know, say we'll free up information, information demands to be free, and everybody have it. They don't recognize that the cultural memes will retrench and repurpose new media, repurpose old media. And the old centralized Big Brother structure, which was there by 1945, has found new ways to reinforce itself, partly because the people want centralization. In the media ecological view, we're never pro or con any new movement.
Yeah.
We are looking at the dynamics, and then we can have an opinion and react to it. But that's what I begin with. So you see what you mean?
Yeah. That's helpful. What's your name for the opposite impulse to the one that refuses what it doesn't already know, that wants itself confirmed? What is your name for that?
You're going to have to say that again. Too many double negatives.
What's your name for the opposite of the? There's this thing you object to, the retrenchment, the fear of anything new, the idea that culture must reflect back what you've already heard of. There's that. But what is this other thing which, for us, immediately we heard? Deborah Cadabra on Bongo Fury, we liked it. Immediately Vaclav Havel heard it. He heard it. He loved it. And there's no possibility that Vaclav Havel, growing up in Prague, could know at all what the words are to Deborah Cadabra or what it could have been about. Or he was responding to something else. Now, what is this something else? Or when Eugene Schadbourne read about music that the critics were calling Nazi music, and he was thinking... punk, and he was saying, why should they be playing that? And he immediately investigated it because he wanted to know what this absurdity was, and he found it was anti-Nazi music. But this, what is this ear for the thing that doesn't fit? And do you have a name for that?
Okay, so I'm not sure, but let me try it this way. I want to surprise you. My name for that reaction is Medium. The Medium. The medium is not, as McLuhan defined it, the new environment. That's just a figure. Or the new invention. The medium is all the media that's already been there and the social structures, including capitalism. That is the reaction. That's one way. So you can call it the medium. You could say the user is the content. You could say it's a rearview mirror. But I think I was going to say that, what I just said. But I think you're talking about how we respond to why we look for something that's different.
Well, we are able to talk to each other, aren't we, over the oeuvre of Frank Zappa. It's because Frank Zappa did something to communal garden hit music. He created something that some people just call puzzling and we call delightful. He created some kind of interruption in the normal flow. And I want to know what we call that. You're saying it's something to do with the medium. Is it something that's within the medium that is commenting on the medium?
Yeah, it's the user as the content. So our user finds meaning or something valuable in the experience. So we brought our own prejudice to the experience of Zappa. And then you would get into personality temperaments and why someone likes that image. That's the psychological way of looking at it. Mm. Or whatever.
And people often do, don't they? When you say you like Zappa, they often say, among a bunch of friends, there's always one of them that likes Frank Zappa.
Yeah, so I can recognize that classification of my response, but I don't know what you call the perversity for the new. In other words, it's a suicide. I call it suicidal impulse, because you're opening for something to destroy the image you have of yourself or of the limited experience you think you're having. Isn't that sort of what it is?
Yeah, that's beautiful, and that reminds me of Ken Fox on his show on Regina Community Radio. Ken Fox at one point said, because I want you to commit suicide. And then he said, no, not your material body. I don't mean that. But he wanted people to kill their own, what's called...
their old medium, conditioned by.
Or what some people call your identity, in the sense of something that needs confirmation. There's a lovely line from Zappa where he talks about most music confirms people's identity and projection towards the future.
Yes.
Which is their concept of their, which sort of combines your bourgeois career and your sense of self in one sort of phrase.
Yeah, you call it your audio wallpaper.
Yeah. Whereas, what are we looking for? We're looking for something that might interest us.
Well, see, we have to look at ourselves in different phases. I mean, we could say we're just looking to get laid. You know, and this opened a new way.
Now, come on, Bob, let's have a bit of realism. Frank Zappa Records never got you laid.
Oh, you worked for me. But I found the other nihilists and suicidal people.
Yeah.
I was lucky. But how do we look at this? It is an ongoing query about what we are. Why does anyone like one thing? Beefheart said, he said, I never understood why one person picked Pepsi and the other guy took Coke. You remember that?
Yeah.
That line?
Yeah.
That's something. It's pretty hard to figure out why we go for things, and we could say suicidal tendency. Probably in the 20th century, there's so much mass consumption that you, if you're reasonably observant, you're going to be your individualist self, and that's all Westerners are going to be upset at the mass group mind. So you're going to look for something that you instinctively know. Oh, this is not. They're not going to like this. And so that's a kind of social suicide, or it's reacting to the mainstream. Now, what's interesting now is that people, like you say, what is happening now? Digital art in the 20s, audio art in the 60s, I say tactile art since then. No one knows what to bounce off of anymore. It's so fragmented. So we can't even, a young person, how are they going to assert their identity? Well, they find ways to do it, their preference, their suicide. But as you get older, what is it we're reacting to? You know what I mean? Does this make any point, what I'm saying to you about the problem of the day?
But we're doing this conversation because we're putting out feelers, aren't we? We're trying to invite in people who feel like us. And
we're also trying to create the experience that we thought Zappa or Phineas Wake did to us. You know, we're trying to continue that tradition.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. And and using rationality to do it, that we don't think we can, that simply making funny noises on the radio or, bending the wire or making it distorted.
Or speeding up the tape.
Or speeding up the tape. I mean, if speeding up the tape's interesting, it's interesting to talk about it. It's interesting to talk about what it does. Because it throws you into the difficulty of, if we tape this program and then listen to it fast, what would that be? And I'd say it's actually that enables us to have the dialogue, is our imagination about of listening to it from the outside. It's what Freud called the superego, or what Christians call God. And for us, it's our, I'm not quite sure what name we have for it, but it is what enables us to talk. Because it's that sense of responsibility of looking above each of us talking and trying to get our point across, which allows us to have a discussion which develops.
Yeah? The Rabelais, 500 years ago, he said he demanded everybody to put down their rake and their hoe, whatever they were doing, and read his work, whichever one it was, Pantagruel or whatever. He demanded everybody to stop, and he said this. You must all stop what you're doing and pay attention to what I've created. That's an interesting position, because Zappa even, I was going to say that we're unique because we admit what we're trying to do most. And then I thought, Zappa did it. He said, we are the other people, found a way to get to you. it's the Menippean describes what he's doing, that he wants you to succumb and be killed by you. You know what I mean? You admit it. So we're doing that, but we're not doing it in the conventional way because it is a nihilistic culture, isn't it? Most people, whether they know it or not, are destroying themselves in different ways. And they celebrate nihilism. So Arthur Croker's done a whole book on this. So we're trying to bounce off, counter the nihilists by not being nihilistic. We're trying to be rational and conversational and, quote, honest.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we're trying to have a conversation about this stuff, and we're not sure what we think of it yet, and we need each other to talk to work out what it is.
Yeah, we unusual because we, quote, know a lot of different things. We can digress all over the place, and we've lost already. We are not focusing on your epiphany about the speeded up tape.
Well, I thought I was because I came back to it because I'm talking about what is this imagination about ourselves in the light of eternity that allow, or God, or this other thing, this way of, or the sped up or the slowed down person that can hear us as little gnats twittering at each other, that imagining that, I'm saying, is the basis of dialogue, that the dialectic is based, the dialectic, the discussion, the ability to have a real conversation with someone is based upon an imagination of a third listener. Somebody judging us, somebody listening. I mean, I suppose the idea I have in my head is of other people listening to us. That's what stimulates me. I mean, I wouldn't be having this, I wouldn't be having an hour-long telephone conversation with you every week. It's because I'm aware of our performing in front of an imaginary audience that we're trying to create that I'm stimulated to talk to you, Bob.
Isn't that what we were saying about, or I was saying before we started recording, that people, like when you hear something on tape that was a radio program, it's not as exciting as listening to the radio live and everybody sharing the same space, which McLuhan said it's the sharing of the same space that's more prominent, more important than what's actually played on the radio. And you get the sense of sharing the same space because we're doing Skype, which is sort of like a conversation, but we get to put it on the radio. So it's the live aspect, the live challenge.
But I'm saying in a way that the most stimulating part of what we're doing is actually the dead aspect.
What is the dead aspect?
It's creating a discussion that produces ideas that can be viewed from not from enjoying the particular
space
that we're doing now, but as definite insights about things which can be carried away and used.
Yeah, which is what you brought up when I was talking about that you want to make something that survives the need to have the emotion of multitude, that is not limited to the emotion of multitude. It's the validity as an object. And that's, again, another big question under the quicksand of electric media. Nothing has any staying power. So the only way we can do that is we talk clearly about the dilemma of trying to do what we're proposing to do, right? We're saying we can't do it. Maybe that's considered honest. Is that it? Do you want to say something to that?
I'm not quite sure where I've got to there because I'm thinking that I'm not sure. You've never given me any sense of recognition when I'm saying it's imagining us. Are you totally in the flow now? Is it the flow that you're in, that you're enjoying, or do you have some imagination about this dialogue as an object which we'll put on archive.org?
Yeah, maybe just the fact that I don't respond means that I enjoy it and agree with it. And so I look, and there's my perversity. I look for the way to counter what you're saying, even though I'm enjoying what you're saying, you know. I'm trying to, that's why I like Zappa. He's trying to counter what's happening. Now, I'm not a person who likes to disrupt. I mean, probably you're like this. We're very polite in a grouping, you know what I mean? We don't try to be, we're not James McDougal yelling and screaming at everybody in a party or something, right? We're not like that.
Well, not usually, no. Yeah.
Not usually, we're polite. But it's almost like, oh, here, I can get on the radio. There's no party, nobody around. Nobody can, I don't know who I'm aiming this at, so I'll go for everybody. You know, there's something different here. I become nihilistic when I get on their air, which is what McLuhan predicted. Everybody, when they get discarnate, electrified, they have an identity crisis with their chemical body and they get nihilistic. They get violent. We're actually doing a kind of violence here. We want to annoy and upset people. We declared 10 shows ago that annoyance is our main point here.
Uh-huh.
Now, I don't do that in person at a party or in the chemical body gathering. I don't try to annoy people. If the conversation starts going in certain areas, after a while, I might say a few things. But we're constantly trying to annoy people here, and we can get away with it because there's nobody around. And even if we were on the radio and we were dealing with people in an interview, we're still nobody's around because they can't find us. Now, if you had a job, you might get fired for doing something like Esther might get in trouble for what something she said, right, on Radio 4, whatever it was she was on. But so McClune would say, hey, Mr. Zappa, you're making all this outrageous stuff because you're on the radio, but there's nobody to hold you responsible for what you're saying. You know, and the only way to stop you is to turn the environment off. But as long as we have the radio TV environment, we're going to have all this social communicational anarchy, and that might upset people. Now, McClune himself, with that proviso, did go on and try to annoy people. That was his definition. So,
although, I mean,
that's the perversity of human consciousness.
I mean, I'm not sure one can seamlessly go from us to McClune, because McClune became a star in the 60s, didn't he? I mean, he was on talk shows. He was a figure, you know. It's rather unlike us. I mean, this is a kind of underground operation.
He became a star, well known, but it did not affect his personal life. This is what Tom Wolfe in the famous essay said: here's McClune becoming this big guy the corporations wanted, and McClune's up there marking papers. He continued doing his teaching and stayed in his chemical body role of teaching, and that's what he wanted to do. He did not have his life changed by the celebrity. Not at all, one bit. Matter of fact, when I interacted with him at some point in the early 70s, when Jonathan Miller, your British friend there, and started writing books, doing hit jobs on McClune, he even said, well, obviously I'm getting to people. I've struck a nerve, so I'm backing off. I'm not going to do public interviews for a couple of years. He actually did a media ecology. He laid low, not out of cowardice, but he just said, it doesn't serve anybody when you're at the lame duck phase or when people are just going to go after you because you have already become famous.
Yeah, well, so he understood that in the conversations he was having, he wasn't getting anywhere, was he? I mean, he wasn't getting his ideas across. But
yeah,
he said
celebrity didn't work.
I mean, you say we want to annoy people. I kind of, there are all sorts of people I hope I'm annoying who don't agree with what I'm saying. And I mean, like one of the people in the magazine I used to write for, I had something published in a book called Noise and Capitalism. And he says on his blog, you know, when is this clown going to be put out to grass? And,
Let's go personally punch him out.
I mean, I'm hoping, you know, Tony Harrington will be very annoyed to hear my voice and my opinions on any kind of broadcast medium. So I hope that this annoys him. But for annoying, you see, I don't think we are trying to annoy. We haven't got a complacent TV host who is reducing us to some kind of comical act or something insulting. So I'm not trying.
We're trying to annoy the people who we know don't have any clue what we're talking about or why we're interested in this, like this guy, this clown you quoted, Tony. But we also are trying to gather together a following to have a revolution. So, yes, we're only 50-50 annoying, you know.
Yeah.
We're also trying to inspire. Because I think what we talk about is exciting because it's never been heard before to put together these different influences and to use it to existentialize our situation.
Yeah, and to reflect on what we're doing while we're doing it, and to insist on the relevance of these kind of things, Zappa, Finnegan's Wake, which have been swept under the carpet and ignored or turned into a speciality. And it's taking the speciality out of its box and proposing it as a generality, which is kind of the annoying thing we do, I suppose.
It's annoying, but we're not doing it to be perverse or nihilistic.
We're actually doing it because it's part of our nature. We have to do it as a spider spins silk. We can't survive without mentioning Finnegan's Wake every so often.
I think that we're doing nutrition. We actually have, McClellan used to talk about the new poets, the great writers, were nutrition. We're providing something that I know a lot of people who are reasonably perceptive have not had the luck to find out about this good stuff and will like it.
Mm, absolutely. And especially given it as something that you will like rather than something that is useful for you to master, or you will become an expert on this. Or I find myself in this dilemma with I really like all sorts of things that Zappa has taught me about 20th century contemporary classical music, which used to be like the most unpopular, uncool, sort of least sexy thing you could imagine, you know, kind of composers in suits and ties making dink-donk music. You know, it was like in the 60s, that was just, you know, it wasn't groovy, it was horrible. And that's the way Zappa liked it. Now it's become kind of, with Sonic Youth and so on, quite cachet to mention that you're into Stockhausen or something like that. And people always choose a not a very good example of 20th century music when they're making these kind of moves. And so I feel kind of sometimes ashamed of liking 20th century classical music because of its use as some kind of cool addendum now. And then people come and talk about how they've worked at it and they've studied it and they've and suddenly they're experts on this thing. And exactly why I like it is because it demolished expertise, that all the people who thought they knew classical music were suddenly completely puzzled and had to actually be honest and respond to what this noise was and whether or not they liked it. That was the bit I liked. If people become experts on this chaotic, disgusting music, I find that as disgusting as simply sitting there feeling complacent because you know Mozart. You know, it's nothing. It's culture as some kind of awful pedestal that you're climbing on. And I hate that. That's the end of all culture. And I'd rather listen to a baby gurgling than that kind of music or person.
Right. I think maybe I got a name for this. We are the I don't know faction. We don't mind people knowing things, but if they start making the knowing a disservice, that's what we're reacting against. So we knew Zappa was different and McLuhan was different, that Fiddings Wave was different because it upset people's knowing.
Well, we like it because it makes us productive. We don't actually claim to know about Zappa or Finnegan's Wake, although we'll have a good battle with anyone else who claims to know about it. We know just as much,
we know as little as they do. Know more than anybody about
it. Yeah, but what's interesting about these things is it makes us productive. This is my argument with the wrong kind of Zappa fan, is they turn it into something where they're never doing anything. They're always gazing at this other thing. And I want them to do things with these skills they've been equipped with. And I suppose that's why I particularly agree with you, whose position is that Zappa's done this, therefore it enables you to do this, that, and the other.
Yes, and why are you... You have a certain known quality in London. And can anybody get on Resonance? Why do these people, Resonance, put up with your ramblings for 5 years? You know, why are you on there?
Well, I'm get on quite well with the people who run it. I'm always there on time and deliver my show. Ed Baxter's got quite a literate sort of person. He wrote a PhD on De Quincey using Derrida, so he appreciates the fact that I'm writing every week. So, Chris Weaver was talking to me about Colin Nankara. So,
They know you personally. You got on because of your personal relationship.
Yeah.
The fact that you wrote for Wire and all that, that's not a factor?
It's a plus that I'm no longer involved with it. They're at loggerheads with The Wire, like everybody is.
Oh, okay. I mean, you know, so there's actually a party line almost at Resonance.
No, not at all. It's comfortable there. I've been doing it a long time, and I'm allowed to do what I do. But, I mean, it's only an hour a week, so, that's okay, isn't it?
Right, and then they allowed you to do this. So they respect you some way, and...
Probably not after this show, Bob. Probably this is shot it all to pieces. You know, we've probably gone too far, and we've certainly almost run out of time. So, have you any closing, final benediction?
Well, it's been fun working with you, Chris. It's fun providing content for your lousy network called Resonance FM.
Right.
If it's goodbye, then love you, mean it.
Bob, that's
for the fish.
Thank you, Bob. That's the worst ending we've ever had. Better luck next time, everybody.
Yeah, I don't want to annoy anybody.
Bye, Bob.